Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Draw against Hull has compounded what's been a disappointing week for Norwich City. It's hampered, but not concluded, their top six run. We're going to assess all of the fallout and pick out all of the strands from what was a, it depends how you look at it, half glass half full or glass half empty. It's easy for me to say. We will dissect all of that here on the Pinken.com Norwich City podcast in association with First Bus. I'm your host, Connor Southwell, joined by Paddy Davitt to assess everything that happened on Saturday. So Paddy, I guess that's probably the place to start, really. After this game, we'll look at it in isolation first, then maybe we'll broaden it out. 24 hours or so on, where's your head at with it? Are you is your glass half full or half empty, reflecting on yesterday?
Well, it's where we're coming from. Are we coming from the 90 minutes plus whatever stoppage time that unfolded at Hull? In which case, yeah, it would definitely be half full over the entirety of the game. We know, and we'll get into it, you know, the first 15, 20 minutes, not acceptable, really, in terms of how Norwich started a game, contrasted with how Hull did, and they scored rightly so in that period. But thereafter, you know, and Johannes, as always, very, very clear in his thinking and how he communicates and how he dissects straight after the games. As he said, from that moment on, it felt like it was Norwich in control of the flow of that game and how it played out from there. And by and large, I think he was right. So I guess if you go away from home and for 70 of the 90 minutes, if you want to be simplistic about it, you're more than happy with the Norwich performance. And as I say, me sat there watching that in the stadium, that's how I would have seen it as well. I think on balance, you'd be reasonably content with that. Of course, you'd have wanted to get another goal and get the 3 points instead of the 1 point that they took. But as an afternoon, as an exercise, yeah, no, I don't have an issue with that. But of course, it isn't in isolation. It's not 190 minutes. It's a game at the end of a three-game week where they've taken 2 points from 9 and the first two of those were at home where they've disappointed off the back of manoeuvring themselves into a really strong position in just on the cusp of that top six. So I guess in the broader context, and this is, I'm sure we'll get into this in due course, is probably where the negative elements of the fan reaction lie, not solely about the 90 minutes at Hull, but maybe more where it fits into the links in the chain. But yeah, I mean, if you're asking me what Norwich produced at Hull, would you deem that, you know, a good performance overall? I think you would, if you drill into the elements that we saw that went into that performance. But, you know, any glance at the league table would tell you they're 12th, they're 4 points off the playoffs, and there's a whole pack of clubs to clamber over. So yeah, nobody's trying to kid anybody that in the bigger picture, there's probably right to be frustration that things aren't coming quick enough. But as an afternoon, no, I was pretty content with what I saw from Norwich, really, overall, after a pretty shaky start.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because you're right. You look at the week as a whole, and it's 2 from 9 against 3 clubs that are 15th or below, I think. Obviously, one of those in the relegation zone, one of them literally just above the relegation zone. They were in the relegation zone before, obviously, Derby got beaten 4-0 at QPR. It's a shame that Derby didn't come to Carrow Road and try and play and open up in the way that they did on Friday night against QPR. But that's life, I suppose. But you bolt it onto what they did in their last away game at Watford. And actually, you'd say those two away performances, barring probably the second half at Vicarage Road, where maybe they should have gone and pushed a little bit more for the second goal, coupled with the first 15 minutes, there's what, 45 and 70. You can do the maths on that because I struggle. Is that 115 minutes or so? Maybe slightly less than that, of good stuff over two games, which I think is pretty positive. So yeah, you can split this and argue this however you like, but I guess probably the place to start, Paddy, is that slow start. And that is ultimately probably the most frustrating aspect, because you're right, so much of what they did at the MKM Stadium was good. They should have won the game anyway, probably. They created the opportunity, certainly in the second half, to do so. But we're probably looking back and reflecting on that 15 minutes being the reason why they didn't.
Yeah, well, yes and no. I mean, obviously, you know, when they did very early on in the second half, 90 seconds after the restart, get themselves on level terms, there's a huge relative, huge period, pretty much this whole of the second half to go and get the second one. And we know how close they came with that sort of shot that Borja Sainz stabbed against the post in around about the 75th minute, I'm going to say off the top of my head, and a lot of other final third entries. You know, there was moments of real promise, and they just couldn't find another ruthless incision to turn that game completely around. But in terms of setting a tone, yeah, no, that was far from what was required. And given that Johannes had quite clearly said it, it's pre-match, that, listen, this is a team who at that point were in the bottom three, two home wins all season. That's the worst in the championship. They are scrapping, to lapse into cliche, for their sort of championship lives, really. So there was always going to be that aggressiveness and that intensity, almost desperation at the start from that whole team. And he framed it that way. So why were Norwich off the pace? That's the frustration, I think. When he sort of was quite clear that it was how they didn't press and that they hadn't got their press quite right. He talked about they adjusted it after the goal in terms of how they structurally looked from the front of the park. And yeah, there's no doubt that clearly did have an impact, and quite a dramatic impact in terms of how that game tilted. Because I don't think after the first 15, 20 minutes, you would have felt Norwich would go on then and possession-wise and maybe in terms of the flow of the game, dominate the remaining 70. That just was not on the cards. And yeah, that it's not a concern maybe, because you know you know it's all right looking at what Norwich didn't do, but Hull were good in that period. You know, they had Gelhardt on the right hand side, gave Lucien Mahovo a torrid time in that first 15-20 minutes. Louis Barry was threatening to do likewise with Callum Fisher. Through central midfield, they were very energetic, high tempo. So Hull got a lot of things right in that opening spell, but I think it was compounded by, you know, from what Johannes seemed to infer, that the setup wasn't quite right in terms of out of possession and what they were trying to do and what they then did subsequently do. And of course, a lot of focus within that period probably does rest on Jacob Wright, Jakob Sorensen, Anis Bentlemani. And that first 15, 20 minutes culminating in the goal, you look at the goal, it's come from an attacking midfielder, Matt Crooks. He's ran off, well, Sorensen's kind of got attracted out to the left-hand side. And Jacob Wright just let him run past him, and he swept it in very nicely at the near post from their point of view. So, yeah, that is a frustration, because having been identified that was going to be how they were going to come at you, then to allow them to do that would seem, you know, a bit of a failure, whether that's failure on the player's part, failure on the coaches collectively. But, yeah, off the back of those two other very below par home games, yeah, it was more of the same, sadly. And, you know, at that point, you did fear that this was going to be a really bad week. And you know, whatever the negative elements of the reaction to what unfolded yesterday, even at 1-1, I think that would have paled if they'd have gone on and, heaven forbid, you know, Hull had gone 3, gone 4, and Norwich had walked off that part well beaten. So it wasn't that. But it's another reminder, you know, you go anywhere in the championship, even a team who at kickoff are out of the bottom three on goal difference, It doesn't really equate to you know, you're going to be able to just, certainly away from home in the championship, you'd have to be very naive to think you could just go there, ease yourself into a game, play at a lower pace, less intensity, less tempo, and expect to set up a game that's going to go in your favour. That just doesn't happen. We saw it at QPR, off the top of my head, Portsmouth, Oxford on the opening day. It doesn't matter if it's Sheffield United or Leeds, or if it's the lower end of this division. Away from home is a very difficult assignment.
Yeah, it is, and I think, you know, it's the age old thing in the Championship, isn't it? If you think you've cracked it, and you think maybe there's an easier game coming up, and you just take your foot ever so slightly off the accelerator, then you can get punished by any team at this level, and particularly, you know, sometimes, and we see it all the time, particularly this time of year and heading into the run in, that you can go to those places and those teams that are struggling, that are fighting for every inch and every point, that's so valuable to teams at the bottom end. Norwich, you've been there before, albeit maybe in the Premier League more recently, but certainly historically. And you know how big a point can feel in those circumstances. And they put so much into those into those performances. So it's never easy, probably even more harder to go to some of those teams at the wrong end of the table towards the end of the season than it is maybe those in mid-table who maybe like a Norwich at the moment who have very little to play for, albeit I think everyone probably at the moment still has elements and things to play for. The second half, though, Paddy, I think is a 45 minutes. If you put the Watford 45 minutes and then that 45 minutes together, I think you'd be pretty close to a really decent away performance where Norwich, and Johannes has spoken about this a lot, particularly away from home, they've really struggled to impart what they want to do in terms of control and possession and converting that into opportunities. If you look at those two halves from two games, admittedly, that there is evidence that they can do it away from home and in the right circumstances and maybe not even at their strongest personnel. So again, if you're looking for kind of positive strands, I think that's an element that people can cling on to.
And for me, what links those two is how those halves unfolded and the fact that it was, and this cuts to what Johannes said to us after the game yesterday, more or less, and he was being a bit prosaic in the choice of language, but his message pretty much to his team was, give me my team back. Give me the team that I recognise. And by that, you know, colloquially, the Hofball brand of football, which is what we saw in that first half at Watford, that control, that ease on the ball, that ability to go left and right and manoeuvre yourself through the pitch. And then, importantly, create chances at the final top end of the pitch, which has, on occasion, more than on occasion, been a criticism of this team, that they look good at certain parts of the game, but they just probably coincided when Sargent wasn't in the side. They don't have that cutting edge. And second half at Hull, very similar. And Johannes touched on that. It was structurally what he wants to see. It was that centre-back's very comfortable taking the ball and manoeuvring it into the midfield. The midfield's distances and how they operated affording those attacking players the space to try and create. And obviously, you know, threat from wide areas as well. So it worked how he envisages it is my take on that second half yesterday. And that's why, as you rightly said, you know, I'm sat there in the press room at Hull off the back of three games where they haven't won a game, but I'm happy because he, again, as he always stresses, he says he doesn't look at the league table. I'm sure he knows exactly where they are in the league table, but he doesn't place his benchmark by what points they're clicking on or ticking over where they are currently in the league table. It's about performance. And for him, performance is, are they implementing the style of football that he believes is him, representative of him and his coaching staff, the one he believes will bring success over the mid to longer term to this football team? And he clearly feels that is the case, certainly in that second period at Hull, certainly maybe in that first half at Watford. But as he also said yesterday, the frustration is, and this applies equally to this past week and maybe the whole season now, you know, the consistency has been not there, it's been lacking. Consistency in result, consistency in performance. You know, he might argue justifiably consistency in team selection, which hasn't been in his own hands a lot of the time. And again, we're in a cycle like that. But, you know, that's underlined graphically by that league table. Played 33, won 11, drawn 11, lost 11. That is average. Let's be honest.
12.
That is, and 12th in the table. That is dictionary definition average. So, you know, again, it probably cuts to where we are with this project for those who can deal with that word when you talk about it in football terms, which is some good, some not very good, and some in between. And those facets are stamped through a lot of these performances, and not just from performance to performance, but, and we again saw it at Hull within the 90-minute offering, you know, some not so good that first 15, 20 minutes, some decent stuff as well, and obviously the goal, some excellent, you know, stuff, really. So that's where we are, really. So it was more of the same. But, yeah, I would tend to agree with Torup and the way you set up this part of the podcast, that if you've got, again, consistently, the second half at Hull, the first half at Watford, allied to what they're doing at Carrow Road most weeks, I think you would feel that is progress and things are moving, because I think that would translate into results, points, higher up the table. So it's all relative. And for Johannes, it all comes back to one common denominator, performance.
Yes, indeed. And that probably leans us nicely into maybe some debate on where elements of the fan base are at. And of course, it's difficult because, you know, we can't go out and poll them all. If they want to all comment on the YouTube video, we have however many, 26,000 comments full of opinions. That'd be great. And we'd love to read them and hear them for sure. But it's impossible to do. You can't gauge what each individual fan is feeling. But I think it is fair to say, whether it is a, you know, minority, a vocal minority, however you want to split it, really, there is a feeling from some that are feeling a little bit shortchanged. We've been here before and we've had conversations like this before this season. And, you know, maybe it's been exasperated by what has been, as we documented, a really under par week. And it has been, by any measure, project or no project, to take 2 points from a possible 9 against teams 15 or below. I think it's a poor week, whether you are transitioning to something, whether you're a part of a project, whatever. That is a really poor week. So I don't think anyone would argue against that. I think for me, I the Norwich fans are excellent. I am one. So I think it's easy to sort of say that. But I do think with some people, there have been points in the last, probably a little while, last 2 months or so, where I just want to say, just calm down a little bit. And that's probably on both sides, when, you know, even when they've won a game, when they've drawn a game, when they've lost a game, it just feels like we've spoken about this before, bouncing between extremes. It feels like we're sort of there again. And, you know, every win means they're going to finish in the playoffs and get promoted, and every defeat they're in crisis and it's a disaster and the whole thing needs ripping up. Maybe draws are somewhere in between the two at points. And it was a little bit of that again yesterday, I felt, where, again, admittedly, with the context that this week hasn't been good enough, and that's not to say there shouldn't be any criticism and people should, you know, bang a drum and be in support irrespective of that. I'm not saying that, but I think it's an acceptance. And, you know, Paddy, we've had this conversation so many times this season on this format and away from it, that what they are doing is bigger in the bigger picture. It's bigger than this week and an individual result against Hull or an individual result against Preston. And it's difficult because fans are reactionary by nature. They are emotional by nature because there's that investment on it. But equally, yeah, I and it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on this, but I think there's been, yeah, just a little, I think it's been a bit OTT, shall I say. I think the reaction to maybe both games, where we've had, you know, a couple of weeks ago where anything felt possible and most people thought top six was going to be, a certainty. And we had Yannis off Torrent fist bumping to now. And we've had a really difficult week from an Norwich City perspective. They've taken a limited amount of points and, you know, it feels like it's a disaster. Do you kind of see what I'm coming at? I mean, what's sort of your view on that?
No, I'd agree with all those points. What I would say is, I was sat there in the press box after the game Tuesday night, Preston, and witnessed it firsthand. It isn't just something it's exclusive to social media. I had the misfortune to decide to go on X just after that whole goal, and that wasn't a good place in the Norwich hashtag. Lord alive! But it isn't just social media, because what I'm referring to is, or was, a fairly robust exchange with two or three Norwich fans as they sort of departed in that corner of the City Stand Snake Pit, Lower Barclay area. And they were vocal enough that Borja Sainz and Yohannes himself came across. They were sort of, by that stage, just sort of the centre circle area, heading back towards the tunnel, having done their lap of, you know, appreciation at the end of that game, which hasn't gone to plan, as we know, 1-0 defeat. And it was only 1 minute, 2 minute worth of dialogue. It ended with a handshake. I was obviously fairly detached from it. But having asked Yohannes after the game, you know, he didn't hide from it, that there was some frustration and that they put, clearly him and Borja put their points across, and that they're as desperate as those fans are to succeed and win games. And you know, that almost that human element of it, that, you know, we feel it. We're not detached from it. You know, we feel those emotions as well, and the frustration and disappointment. So that is a microcosmic episode, and yes, it was only two or three fans, but, you know, I did hear it. And when you've got two or three shouting, continuing to shout their frustration, almost berating the coaches and the players, then you can't ignore that is a view, however big that view and however representative it is of the fan base. And of course, it was that post Preston frustration where emotions are, particularly the negative ones, are heightened, and, you know, maybe with a degree of detachment that wouldn't have been quite how they would have expressed that dissatisfaction, or anybody for that matter. But so you have to take that into account. But it is there. It is there on social media, and they're entitled to, you know, they're entitled to express that. You know, those fans the other night at Preston, they're paying punters and they're more than entitled. You know, they give their time, they give their money. Those away supporters travel the length and breadth. We've just had season tickets for the new season released, and you know, you can see the financial commitment that's required to take up or to renew your season ticket. So for all of those reasons, you talk about that emotion and the investment. If you support your football team, you are invested in it. It is an emotional thing. Otherwise, you know, why are you supporting your football? Why are you supporting any football team? They take you on a journey of highs and lows and euphoria when they win and have success and promotions and what have you. And then the opposite when things, whether it's on a micro level of losing a game or whether it's, heaven forbid, dropping down leagues. You know, that is all part of the rich tapestry of being a football fan. So, but I guess your point there, Connor, is whether it's more marked, whether it feels more extreme at the moment, whether that's a more of a broader societal thing. You know, you look around at society in general and that frustration and anger that there is. And we don't need to turn this into a political podcast, but, you know, in a political context, there's very much polarisation now and the old order maybe being challenged and, you know, maybe consensus politics giving way to more populist sort of views and easy answers and blaming groups and what have you, and that's maybe some of that is seeping into, you know, how you support your football team. And that's not just Norwich full stop, that's every football team in the land, that maybe that patience isn't there just in general. Maybe you want that instant gratification, particularly if you're, you know, you're giving that time and financial commitment, you know, to be told that don't worry about it in the here and now, it'll be all good over the hill. Well, will it be all good over the hill? Nobody's got a crystal ball. Nobody can say with any certainty. But all Norwich are trying to do now in this new sort of direction of travel shaped by Torup, Napa, Attanasio and Norfolk Holdings is create as many of the variables in their favour that give them the best conditions to achieve that sustainable mid to longer term success. That's what this is about. Now, if that's not enough for you in the here and now, then you're going to express that dissatisfaction and call for change if that's what you're calling for, whatever level of the club. But we don't really, because we can't answer it, we don't know where the measure lies. You know, is it a very small vocal minority, but be it on social media or in person in stadiums? You know, is it not even that? Is it just isolated pockets, or is it something more than that? And even within that, you know, there'll be some who are a little bit wavering, but still willing to buy into it, as opposed to ones who have had enough and want to be different. So it's a very complex equation to break down. But I think you'd be naive to ignore that feeling is there, that maybe that this isn't moving at a quick enough pace for some. And they are going to express that dissatisfaction. And, you know, we'll go back to Torup pre-match the other day. I think I can't quite remember what the question, how it was framed, but he was saying that he was frustrated almost on a personal level that this, I think he said something along the lines that the successes aren't coming quick enough, because he knows he's a very, very intelligent, very attuned head coach. And he will know that in terms of courting that public opinion, which him and Napa did at the start of the season, that's so important to take people on a journey with you, that buy-in, you can't take it for granted. You can't ask for that at the start of the season and then don't give people enough evidence to continue staying behind you on this journey, that I think he feels probably they're not at this stage giving them maybe enough wins. And I don't mean wins in terms of purely 3 points, but just wins generally in terms of the project, 33 games into the season. I'm pretty sure that he would feel they would be closer to that top six. The football would be of a better standard. It'd be more consistent. But of course, you know, then again, we get into the mitigation of some very, very key players who have been unavailable for periods of time. So, yeah, I certainly don't think we're at a tipping point or anything anywhere near that. But it would be remiss to ignore that there is a palpable sense of whether you were on board at the start or whether you've been convinced in the good periods that it isn't quite ticking along at the pace that people would like it to go. But you know, as I say, as we've said on this podcast 3 games ago, they are 2 points in 2 places and from the top six, and then in play against Derby when Sargent scores that goal in the 68th minute, they're in the top six for the first time this season. The margins are that fine, and you roll it on 2 or 3 games, they've not won any of those 3, and they're 12 and 4 points adrift. that is the madness of the Championship. But it can turn again just as quickly. And I think that was coming back to the whole game, because there was a lot of positive elements in the performance. I think Giannis is feeling, if you then can, hopefully, we'll get into this, maybe have a McLean or a Nunes to be available in weeks to come, that building on what we saw at Hull, that he feels that they can still get themselves much closer to that top six. And then who knows if they're in and around it with a few games to go. It just, what you certainly can't do at this stage is wring your hands and say, well, that's it, season's over, job done, and build for next season, because I can guarantee Giannis Torop isn't thinking in those terms.
No, he isn't. But again, on the flip side of that, that's not to say that if they, and again, he mapped this out last week, if they don't finish in the top six, I don't think it's by any way a stretch or imagination a failure or a disaster or end of the world territory and stick everything in the dustbin and blow it up either. And I think you're right. And ultimately, it's good that people have those emotions and that they care and that they express them. It's good that we have a wide range of opinions and that people think differently. And there will be a whole host of people, as you mapped out, there will be people who are 100% invested in what Norwich City are doing and what they're trying to do in the direction of travel. And there'll be people on the other end who have seen enough, don't think it's going to work, don't like the head coach, don't like the sporting director, think they've gone too young, don't agree with the strategy. And that's also fine, because of those, and there'll be obviously a myriad of people in between those who are in different ends of that particular spectrum, and all of those views are okay, because ultimately nobody knows, even Giannis Aftorup, even Ben Knapper, even Mark Attanasio, nobody, the people driving this process, ultimately don't know whether or not this is going to be a success, in the same way that those who have gone before them didn't know. Daniel Farke didn't know, Stuart Webber didn't know. All you can do is sort of kickstart a process and go down that road. And you know, my view is, I think after what has been so much change on the pitch, first and foremost, we spoke a little bit about this in last week's pod, but they've gone from fielding the two oldest Championship 11s as they did last year with, what was it, 8, 9 30-year-olds in one starting 11 to this year, where they've gone in completely the opposite direction. And it's not the youngest, but I think it's the youngest Norwich team this century that they fielded this season. You know, and if that ultimately you want to win games and you want to win games now, as they did last season, you stack your team full of players who are ready to do that. Norwich don't do that. I mean, at Hull, they had Fisher at right back. I mean, if you want to win games every week, you start Jack Stacey, left back. You probably don't start Lucien Mahovo on what is his fourth or fifth senior start. You know, you don't throw Jacob Wright in as a 19-year-old. So all of this, and that's not to say nobody wants to win now. You know, you've mapped out. Giannis Aftorup has said he's impatient. He wants to win now. He wants to finish in the top six. He wants to get promoted. But I think he's accepting that even if that's a target, even if that's an ambition, it doesn't mean anything other than that is a failure. And, you know, often when I've sort of tried to speak to people about this, it will be, well, you know, why was it viewed as a failure last year if David Wagner didn't do it with his group of players? If he didn't finish, you know, if he'd have finished sixth as opposed to sixth and outside the playoffs, it would have been considered an unmitigated disaster, and you know, maybe the same outcome of him eventually losing his job would have happened a lot earlier. And I think to that I would say this, which is, and this is why I think I get that they're back-to-back seasons and people want to compare. Norwich finished sixth this year, so they've got to try and finish higher, but I don't think they're that compatible and comparable because of the way that they built that squad. I mean, it wasn't about a style of play. It wasn't about developing young players, building assets. It was a team and a group that was built to win and win effectively and win at all costs. It wasn't about the next 2 years, the next 3 years, the next 4 years. It was about that year and winning. And that's fine as an approach. Plenty of teams do it. I think Sheffield United are a good example this year of another team in that mold. But if you're going to do that, you have to win. Yeah, because there's not a lot of substance but behind that. And, you know, after what has been 2 years or so, really, where Norwich have been very short-term, 3 years probably, in their outlook, and it's costly, and they've brought players in on short contracts but on big wages, and obviously they've freed some of that up. It takes time to reverse that process. And, you know, again, I've no idea. Nobody has any idea if it's going to be success. But I think it's worth sticking it out, and it's worth seeing. And it's worth seeing if this journey that they're on at the moment can result in success. And that's not to say that there shouldn't be criticism and it should be a blind, you know, leap of faith behind it, because that's not the case. Giannis Aftorup has got things wrong. Norwich City have got things wrong this season. We've said it. You know, probably not adding a striker in that regard. You know, maybe before Jacob Wright, we had a big discussion about whether they should sign a midfielder on loan. They eventually did. So there has been mistakes along the way tactically and in terms of their strategy. So Yeah, I mean it's a tough one, and like I say, I think the majority, and certainly, you know, you look at that away end at Hull yesterday, Paddy, and this is why I think it does need to be put into context. The bulk of those that were there did stay, did, you know, clap and all of those things, and I'm sure not all of those were very happy with the performance. But for me, it's a bad week. I don't think it needs to be the end of the world. You know, it doesn't need to be everything's rubbish and everyone's rubbish and whatnot. And I'm not saying that is the case generally, but yeah, I just think everyone needs to just relax a little bit and just let it play out and see what happens, because the alternative to that, Norwich tried that, they failed, they're still in the Championship. And, you know, I would be very shocked at the moment if anybody feels that Norwich City are going to get promoted to the Premier League. If they do, great. I think we've seen probably in the last week why they're not going to. And so we are realistically, whether they finish in the top six or whether they don't, we're looking at another season in the Championship. And I guess the final point I would make on this is, you know, again, people have made the point, well, you know, this is their best opportunity. Next year, they might not have Borja Sainz, they might not have Josh Sargent. And that's true. In likelihood, they won't. But as part of the process, they're on two things, really. You have to, I guess, trust the recruitment that you're on to replace those players. And again, there'll be a spectrum of people that do trust them to do that, and there'll be people that don't. We'll have to see, and the proof will be in the pudding. And I think a very live example of that is, you know, Paddy, you covered that season. I don't want to keep harking back to it because it is the one that has been harked back to a lot. But at the end of that 17-18 campaign, was it like 47 goals that they took out of their team in Madison, in Murphy, in Oliveira? Harrison Reed departed. Angus Gunn, who was on loan, he departed. There were key cogs of that team that left, and it wasn't it certainly didn't hinder them. And that's not to say that next season is guaranteed just because this year's been like 17-18 that next year's going to be the Farker 18-19. It the likelihood is it won't be. But again, I think it is just worth sort of seeing how things play out and letting it play out, because we've had 3 years of the alternative and that didn't really work.
All I would add to that's cycle of players leaving and going. Look at Brighton. That's how Brighton have done it. Their recruitment has been, for the scale of club they are, off the chart. Finding players in the short term, improving their team. In the mid to longer term, massive transfer sale regeneration of funds. And that then has allowed them to buy a better grade of player. That's the model. That's what they're trying to do here at Norwich, but it takes time. Brentford, maybe to a lesser extent to Brighton. But again, you know, sole players kept moving forward because they had a clear strategy of how they wanted to do things. So that is the answer to, yes, they may lose Sargent, they may lose Science this summer, just as they lost Sara and Adam Eder last summer and every other, the Madison, as you rightly said, that summer, and Jacob Murphy. So that's a given. But if you do it well and you trust your recruitment processes, then Brighton have shown and Brentford have shown it is possible to still move forward while selling, if you want to call them, your best players in every given period. And the only other thing I would say to maybe draw this to a close is there wasn't a choice. You know, once they effectively, what that summer of Barnes, Stacey, if you want to throw him in, Duffy. I'm sure I'm missing one other, but
for sure, Fashnack.
That was the last roll of the dice. That was the last roll of we're going to throw money at this in a bid to get us parachuted back into the Premier League. And they got into the playoffs, but they were so far off Leeds, it was embarrassing that second leg at Elland Road. That was the end of it. That you look at the accounts for the last 2 years now, graphically illustrates in a post parachute world. They simply cannot go down that same route of throwing money at it. High salaries for Norwich, big transfer fees. It's not sustainable. It hasn't been sustainable. Now, of course, the answer people might be screaming at me is, well, they've now got paper billionaire in Mark Attanasio and his group. Look at what he's done with the Brewers for 20 years. He hasn't thrown huge amounts of money at it. They've tried to be astute. They've tried to invest. And as he's done in business, he's been very successful at investments and finding the right investments. That's how he's ran the Brewers. It's incremental. It's trying to be harnessing data. They're in a small market in terms of baseball. They're competing against much bigger fish, yet season after season, for them, their measure of success, they're able to get a team good enough to go to the playoffs. But it isn't, look at his wealth, here we go. And anybody who thought that is delusional. That's not how he's operated with his baseball team. That's not how he's going to come in and operate and hasn't and won't moving forward with Norwich. So it isn't that they that this policy they're on now in terms of, as we know, trying to develop players, try to almost look at a mid to longer term view. It's not that it's that or something else. It had to be this. There wasn't an alternative that involved financial means, because they haven't got the financial means, or at least they haven't got an ownership group who are willing to go that route. So for me, it's almost a redundant argument in that respect about why are they going down this strategy path? Why are they on this project? Can't we do something different? Get something else different in its place? As if there was a choice. There really wasn't a choice. Not if you wanted this club to continue competing at a good level in the Championship and then hopefully get back to the Premier League, which, you know, anybody accuses that of being a lack of ambition. Asensio has made it clear. I think he give it a 5-year time frame when we spoke to him after the AGM. He wants to be in the Premier League. Torrop said, well, he's come to this club to get his team back to the Premier League, and both him and Glenn think that's achievable within the next 3 years. Do you think Ben Napa leaves this position at Arsenal to come to Norwich and just tread water in the Championship? Absolutely not. He's very ambitious, I'm sure, as well, in terms of his career path in football. So you have ambitious people driving a project which has that same ambition to get to the Premier League, but it's how you do it, clearly, and it's not going to be throwing huge sums of cash at it, because that isn't an option, frankly.
Yeah, and I think also, just to sort of round off this debate, and I do want to come back on one of your points in a moment, but, you know, it's also, you can't just keep doing different things and going in different directions and saying, well, you know, we tried this for 8 months and it didn't work and we're going to bin it off and go down something else, because it's, you end up where Stoke are at the moment, where, you know, they've thrown so many different things at a wall in terms of head coaches and recruitment staff and directors of football, and they've just gone in this circle, and you regress, it becomes a little bit of a death cycle. You can't do that. You've got to have, you know, those people have got to have the courage of their convictions. And this is when you see it, when, you know, things aren't going as well, where you're not winning games consistently, where there is a little bit, irrespective of how big that is, of pushback. Let's see how much they believe in it and whether they're going to double down on it and whether they're going to truly do it. But this year was always going to be about realignment and change and transitioning. And of course, within that, if Norwich could get in the top six, brilliant. But if they don't, it's not the end of the world. And hopefully, come the start of next season, they're in a better position with another window to really attack that. One point I did want to push back on, because I know people will be screaming at you.
Push
for
back on one of my points, Connor. What's going on?
I'm not saying I disagree with you, but there will be people watching. You go, well, hang on a minute. Paddy's saying, you know, that this isn't a wash with cash, but, you know, 8.5 million on Siennats, 4 on Cordoba, 4 on Force, and 5.8 on Eurosec. They'll be pointing out that decent outlay in terms of transfer fees. That is all.
But that's actually a good aspect of this debate, because, again, if there's a negative connotation to that, it's that they haven't turned into peak, James Maddison in very short order, because that patience isn't there to give them the time to. I mean, all of those players, this season for me is a bedding in season. You know, it's unrealistic to expect any of those players. But where the waters get coloured is Cernach at 8.5, because you think with that outlay, you're getting a ready-made player who can come in and affect it. And to be fair, you know, Johannes hasn't shied away from that. He is one for the future, but he should have probably produced more. I don't think anybody disputes that. Evidence of he is an £8.5 million player in the making. I don't think we've seen enough of that. But for me, you know, I keep coming back with him. I think he's probably Sargent's long-term successor, because, you know, the way they're trying to, and that cuts to the previous point about how you recycle squads and how you navigate, because Sargent will go at some point. If it's not this window, it will be windows to come. And then, you know, if Cernach had been able to shadow him, learn from him, Ben Napa was very open at that AGM in November. He is a striker. They see him as a striker. So if that's the case, and Torrop only plays with one striker, then it's obvious that his window of opportunity will be in a post-Sargent world. So, you know, but that's not to dispute that in the here and now, he doesn't look like value for money. But I think it's very premature to go after him or any of those other players. Because we've seen, you know, even Science, and I know Science wasn't a transfer fee, but look at the acceleration in his from last season to what he did in the first part of this season. And we know he's hit a bit of a fallow period for very many reasons. But it can happen just like that. It can be a space of months that these players really catch. And if they don't, then much like with Torup and Napa and Atanasio, they will be judged for what they haven't produced and what they haven't achieved. But that, for me, isn't in the here and now. Not two-thirds of the way through the first season, really, when all three of those elements have come together. But it's a fair point. I mean, for Norwich, that is reasonably decent outlays of money. But if they think, you know, like Cordoba, for example, we spoke to that data analyst, Omar Chowdhury, and he felt that was astute business because the value of Cordoba, if he develops as he's shaping to do, that will look cheap. And I'm sure that is front and centre with any of these deals that they've put together, that they feel that they've got players in for values that, if they can be developed under Torup and his coaching staff, they will be able to sell them on again, much like with Sara, for example. You know, they turned him around and gave him a platform. He grasped it and by his performances got himself a move for substantially more than Norwich paid for him. Eder as well, you know, you could go through. I mean, Science goes this summer, a free transfer in the building. He's leaving for many, many millions of pounds, even with 12 months left on his current deal. So that's probably where we're at. But it's a fair point. It's a fair point. But my pushback would be that's probably because you're judging them in the here and now. And I don't think that's fair two-thirds into their first season, particularly those younger players coming from a different country, different culture. As I've seen mentioned in various quarters, to zoom out a touch, probably the time to really start making some definitive judgments on Torup, on the strategy on those players, is maybe this time next year when they've had a full season and a half, multiple windows. Torup's had more than enough time to embed, you know, what he's trying to do with these players and turn these players into better players. I think that's, for me, would be the time to start judging a bit more harshly than right now.
No, agreed. It's not necessarily my view, but I thought I'd push it back. So I think it would be a point that was raised. And, you know, to be brutally honest, 8.5 million, that probably is what 8.5 million gets you in this day and age in football, I'm afraid. And it's certainly not where it was maybe a few years ago, albeit still obviously big money for Norwich. And again, I think it's maybe just changing the way we think about some of these investments from, you know, players being attached to transfer fees. Actually, these are guys that Norwich see in the long term making return on its investment. It's the same as sort of investing in stock and trying to see that improve. And that maybe is sort of the analogy I would use at the moment. Where you're at with Norwich City does feel a little bit like a stock investment in terms of, you know, if you invested in it, you're kind of waiting to see a return on that. And if you don't believe in it and you're not invested in it, then you want something else, don't you? So I think that's the way it is at this moment in time.
Connors, also as well, I mean, we're talking about Cernach 8.5. That was the Adam Eder money. It wasn't that they've had to dig deep into some coffers and Atanasio has had to release some funds. That has been the case in maybe some other of the transfer dealings. But that was the money they banked for Adam Eder. Now, to turn Adam Eder into an £8.5 million player, by common consent, on the body of evidence in the Norwich shirt, was a fantastic piece of business. So, you know, again, you can zone in on one deal, incoming deal, without looking at the broader picture. You know, Zara, the money that they banked for Zara allowed them to do two or three of them other deals. You know, Forsen, you could argue, is maybe the Kamara type of money. That's why I think to purely look at the transfer fees they paid for players is indicative that they have spent money. Yes, they have. But it's money that they've brought in from other areas, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, it is. Absolutely. And I think that's worth considering. And like you say, a lot of those players, you know, have come from abroad. They're young. There's a whole lot of unknowns to throw into particularly a first season in England. I mean, you know, remember Marco Stiepemann's first season in England. He spent it as a left back, didn't he? I don't think anyone expected the emergence in year two. Mario Vrančić, likewise, didn't play an awful lot in that first season. There'll be others as well. So it can change, and it does change, and it does turn very quickly. So as you say, I think it's worth just giving it a little bit of time and seeing how it progresses. One thing that hasn't helped Yanis off Torup, whatever way you spin it, is midfielders. And he described it as a curse, but we'll stray in the realm of reality and go down the inconsistency of availability, injuries, suspensions, other aspects to this. We've had a whole long debate before about the sports science element of it and the fitness element of it. And, you know, we don't know. We don't know the type of conversations that are being had. But Norwich City on Saturday, Wright, Sorensen and Slimani, that was their 17th different midfield three combination in, what was that, 33 championship games. That's basically a different one every other game. It's an extraordinary number. Jacob Wright is the 11th separate different player to play in one of those three positions. I mean, the reality is, Paddy, when that area of the pitch, which is so important to what Johannes Hofstra wants to do, the control that Norwich City want to assert on games, is so up in the air and the pieces are so interchangeable, it's going to be near on impossible, isn't it, to achieve any sort of continuity and consistency of performance while that's the case?
I think it is. And wherever you are on this spectrum in terms of the project, that you cannot dispute those numbers. I mean, that's a staggering amount of combinations. And then your second point is equally the case. It's not to an area of the team that doesn't really have a major impact in terms of the style of play and what you're trying to do. It is absolutely fundamental, those central midfield areas, to how he wants his players, his team, to manipulate the ball, to move the ball, to create opportunities, that control element as well. It all stems from the same place of his team. And, you know, particularly Nunes, particularly McLean, they are, I think by common consent, the first two in that central midfield mix. If you were sitting down with a blank sheet of paper and who are his three central midfielders, I can't think there'd be too many, if any, Norwich fans who wouldn't put Nunes and McLean as one and two, whatever order. And to not have them yesterday again, and the alternative is, and it's no reflection on Sorensen or Wright, but it's one player who's had his own injury issues and one player who is very raw and may turn into a good player, but at the moment the intensity and the physicality, because he's not ever experienced it before, so why would you expect to drop him into Preston and Hull and that he would look, you know, 24 carat? That's completely unrealistic. So yeah, for me, I mean, that's irrefutable that Giannis has in that regard had no look whatsoever, whether it's a curse or not, you know. But and I think in that answer he gave yesterday about why he sat here and I've not won a game in three, but I'm still very positive because of the performances. He also added in that hunt for consistency that when they get those players back and they can, you know, hopefully between now and the end of the season, have a more settled 11, that familiarity will come through in the performances. And we've seen that in the better periods of the season, I think, when they've had a consistency in selection, and that includes, you know, the key players, certainly down that spine, that has translated into, you know, some very, very polished performances, plenty of goals, plenty of control. I'd be amazed if anybody was, that's an excuse, put that to the side, he should be better, he should be able to get more out of the other available options. And it's not meant to be harsh, but when you've got Nunes or Jacob Wright, then I think at this stage, it's clear that that's going to have a detrimental impact in terms of the overall performance of your team in those key central midfield areas. And McLean, well, we know the stats back it up. When McLean's in that team as opposed to not in the team, it's stark. And, you know, moving forward, that clearly is a challenge. And that feeds into the right time to judge Torup and the project more broadly will be maybe this time next season, because I don't think it necessarily will. He'll have the same mitigation if we're still talking about you're missing player X and as a result, the performances, or certainly the midfield performances, are night and day. I don't think that would wash, because he would have had sufficient time to work with these players and to build a squad who are maybe far more even in terms of the performance and their output you get from them week in, week out, irrespective of the combinations that you have to because inevitably injuries and suspensions are part and parcel. You're never going to get through a season without those. But it's how you navigate them. And right now, I guess at this stage of the cycle, the drop off, and we've seen this evidenced, the drop off from the frontline options to the understudies, if you want to call them that, is too big to maintain the performances and the consistency in performances. And we saw that again, you know, don't want to keep harping on, but when Sargent's leading the line as opposed to Cernac, you know, it's stark, isn't it? And that, to a degree, is also the case in central midfield.
And just on Sargent, I mean, what's your view on that situation? Because once again, yesterday we saw him taken off 77th minute. Norwich obviously chasing a winner at that stage. And of course, the optics of that for a fan base is is stark, isn't it? You're taking off the man who scored 5 in 5, has got the goal in the game as well. He's so pivotal to Norwich City's attacking play. Obviously, Jurasek had gone off slightly earlier as well. Can you understand that management of him? Because clearly there's a sports science element to this. And as I said earlier, that's the bit we don't know about. And all we can do really is ask questions about that. We don't have the answers in terms of what they're trying to do. But given he came off earlier in the week, is it a concern that 7 weeks after he came back that Norwich is still in a position where they have to manage him a little bit in back-to-back games?
Well, I mean, as you say yesterday, but I mean, it was Preston. They were losing that game when he came off. And Torrock said, no, I told him the day before, you will play 60 minutes, give or take, and then you will come off, whatever the game state. So that, for me, would have been a harder one for, and maybe, you know, going back to that episode with the fan base, one or two elements of it at the final whistle that night, was maybe some of the frustration came from that you're losing a game and you take off, you know, the only guy who's probably capable of maybe getting you back into this game. In terms of goal scoring output, I don't know if it's a concern or not. I mean, that's the reality. And Torrock will be leaning heavily on the advice he is getting from the sports scientists and the medical practitioners. We know his backstory over these last 2 years and the periods of injury that have punctuated those seasons. And, you know, if they're now erring on the side of caution, you can probably see why that is the case. Because, to go back to the very recent point we made, the drop-off from him to when he's available to not available is marked, and they simply do not have anybody to come in and offer even a passable impression of him at the moment. And that's the truth of the matter. So if Torrock feels that to play him 90 minutes at this stage would be too great a risk, and that he breaks down and re-injures and then that's him for the season, then of course you're going to err on the side of caution. What you hope is that this policy, albeit a tough one in terms of the game states that we've faced in these last 2 or 3 games, does in relatively short order facilitate, okay, he's now at that point, his body is now robust enough, there's enough miles on the clock that he can go 90-90-90 for the remainder of the season. I don't for 1 minute think that we're going to now, I'd be very surprised if that is the case, between now and the end of May, this is Josh Sargent, that every game between now and the end of May, they have to basically only roll the dice for 60, 75 minutes in games. I would think that this phase is designed to get him to a point physically, performance-wise, that he can go long, go 90 minutes, game after game after game. And if this is an uncomfortable period, which it is, in terms of the results, then so be it. But yeah, on this aspect, I think you just have to say, if you're Torrock, if that's the advice he's getting, then you just have to go with it, don't you? Really? I mean, it would be very foolish if the physical data or the sports science and medical elements are telling him one thing and he ignored that advice and then the player breaks down. So that makes no sense whatsoever. You know, they're experts in those fields for a reason. So you have to listen to them, I guess, if you're their coach.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. And the hope is now, obviously, that the fact they've taken this policy over the last 2 games, where they're now going into a cycle where there's a clear week before Stoke, there's then a clear week before Blackburn. You would hope in both of those games that he could play, if not the full game, then definitely a lot more of it than maybe the case has been in this week. And to be fair, last weekend, against Derby, he did play 90 minutes, didn't he? And I spoke to him afterwards and he spoke about the importance of his first 90 minutes. So, he has sort of increased, and it was, what, 60-odd minutes against Preston? It was 77 yesterday. So there has been an increase in his minutes. He's just probably not at a stage where he can play free game week and play all of the minutes in all of them, and that's probably understandable. Obviously, his goal yesterday, 5 in 5 for him. The NCFC numbers account, which I'm sure all people of a yellow and green persuasion are aware of, some brilliant stats on there, produced another excellent one, which is players, I don't know if you saw this, Pad, players to score 10 plus headed goals for Norwich City in the last 20 years. One of them is Josh Sargent. If you saw it, it'll ruin it, but can you name the other two on that list?
No, but I mean, if Grant Holt's not on there, then I don't know.
Holt is one. There's one more.
What time frame was it going back out?
Last
far?
20 years.
20.
So, from 20 to 2005, basically.
Big Ewan?
No.
No? Okay.
More recent than that.
Oh, yeah, 20 years, that would be 2005, wouldn't it? Yeah. That was just after, wasn't it? Headed goals. Bradley Johnson?
No. He's a striker. I'll give you that. He's a striker.
Steve Morrison.
No. Go a bit later. But into basically the next era, so to speak.
So what era would that be? That would be...
Alex Neil, that sort of era.
Cameron Jerome.
Bang on, yeah. Those are the three. Holt, Jerome and Sargent. So that's...
how many did Holt get, just out of interest?
Oh, I don't know. It just says 10 plus. Oh, so right. more than 10. I would imagine that he has scored more than anybody else, though. He was a master at that. Right, let's do just the ticket then. This, of course, is the segment in association with our sponsors, First Bus, where we pick the player who was just the ticket from that weekend. And I feel like I might need to broaden this out to player or thing or animal, potentially, in this debate. But Paddy, from the 90-minute offering, who was just the ticket for you from a Norwich City? Well, it doesn't have to be from a Norwich City persuasion, but usually it is.
Yeah, no, well, I'll avoid the animal running down the wing. Read enough and seen enough about him or they or it already. But I mean, Callum Fisher was good, wasn't he? I thought that was very interesting from Torrop. I mean, he was very candid to us after the game. How it, you know, what was the messaging at halftime to produce that response so soon after? And it was there was no ambiguity. It was Fisher and Mahovo sort out your delivery in the final third, which wasn't good enough in that first half, even though they got themselves into attacking positions. And then it was, I think, he went on to Jacob Wright and Soleimani, your technical midfielders, will show me that you need to be better on the ball. So, but I thought overall, yeah, okay, maybe that element of his first half game wasn't quite on the money. But the way he dealt with Louis Barry, who, you know, the player who was ripping up at Stockport and a lot of clubs wanted him in January, Hull, maybe surprisingly to a degree, took him from Aston Villa on loan. I thought after that initial 10 or 15 minutes, there was one moment, it was almost like he wanted to introduce himself, but there was a big diagonal from Gellart and just on the edge of the 18-yard box, and he's really forcefully gone in, put his body between the ball and Barry and won a free kick in a bit of a wrestling match. So he really set the tone there for me in terms of his personal duel. And then, of course, second half, a wonderful cross in response. And you could see from his reaction, there's one camera shot where he's almost celebrated like he scored the goal himself. So I think Torrop's words would have been ringing there at that moment. And just more evidence of, you know, what a very versatile and very good potential player they have on their hands. I mean, he's already starting to produce, but given his age, given his background as well, where he's come from, you know, there's so much left to extract from him as a footballer. And, you know, for me, yeah, I mean, obviously Sargent's a clear candidate as well, but I think Fisher was just the ticket, assisted by Sammy the Squirrel.
Yeah, Squirrel Regis, as I've heard him described. Yeah, it was a cracking run. I think Fisher has. But if you're looking for success stories of this season, I think Callum Fisher is one there, absolutely, in terms of probably edging out Jack Stacey now consistently for that Norwich City starting right back position. I think. And it was probably the element, I think, where you could probably say he does need to add to his game is that attacking element, and particularly in the final third, making the right decision, producing the right sort of crosses and creating opportunities. And to see him do that was excellent. And it shows the quality that he can do there. And I felt actually throughout the game, there was a nice understanding and relationship between him and Jurasek. You know, an understanding that when Jurasek went in, that he could go out and those type of elements that created the crossing opportunities for him. So, yeah, really, really good talent that Norwich City have on their hands. For me, obviously, clearly it would be the squirrel if we're talking about animals, but I think I'll go with Jacob Wright, who had a really difficult, like Norwich, had a really difficult start to the game. I thought he tried ball out to the right-hand side, I think, on three occasions and got them all wrong and under-hit two and over-hit one. But after that, I thought he really settled into the game and became, looked composed on the ball, very press-resistant, used the ball well, but there was sort of added elements of looked a bit more dynamic in his play. And I think the adjustment of his position alongside Soleimani to get a little bit higher up the pitch had the desired effect. I think he could have maybe hit through the ball with a bit more conviction on the two occasions that it fell to him. But yeah, as you said earlier, given the context of being dropped into obviously the game against Preston, 20 minutes before kickoff, then obviously having to go again in response, I felt that maybe there was some early nerves in there, but I thought he came out of it really well. So yeah, he was just the ticket for me. On the squirrel, because I don't want to talk about him too much. I don't know if you remember, but I had a look earlier, actually, and bizarrely, this has happened before for Norwich City. There was an away game in 2011, which I think was their first Premier League win under Paul Lambert, 2-1. And there is a tweet from the club account about how a squirrel ran onto the pitch, which I don't know if you were there or have any recollection of. But yeah, I don't know whether that's the same squirrel or a relation.
First away win. That was Wigan. But no, they didn't beat Wigan on the opening day.
Yeah, Bolton was the first away win.
Bolton. Right, yeah. No. I don't remember that at all. The Johnny Arson Pigeon episode. That's the only one I can recall.
I remember. Can you remember Chelsea coming to Carrow Road a couple of years ago and that bird? Can you remember that? Basically, it says a lot about Norwich's performance that was the most entertaining thing. And then I also remember a cup game where there was a goose that was flying around Carrow Road, around the perimeter of the Carrow Road. But I can't remember what game that was. So yeah, there's been a few examples of animals, but squirrel is a new one. I actually thought they were going to stop the game at one point, to be honest, when he dashed onto the pitch. So there we go.
It could have ended badly. Thankfully,
it ended with Norwich squirreling an equaliser rather than it becoming an ex squirrel. So we'll leave it there. Stoke next, Paddy at home to Carrow Road. Mark Robbins, obviously a very successful player for Norwich, manager for obviously your team, Coventry. I had a look actually earlier on. He's managed 10 times against Norwich, never won against them. Two draws, which I think one for Covham and one as Barnsley manager, and 8 defeats, conceded 20 goals, only scored 6. So I'm sure he's going to be desperate to do that. He's the latest one to take on that Stoke task. But irrespective of all of this discussion, there's going to be more of that frustration if Norwich City let another Carrow Road opportunity against a, you know, they're not a struggling team. I don't think they're in a relegation. Well, they're at the wrong end of the table, but they're on the right side of the relegation zone. If they let that slip through their fingers again, there's going to be even more frustration, understandably so.
Yeah, they had a win yesterday, didn't they? I think.
Yeah, beat Swansea, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, there'll be absolutely no danger with Robbins there of them getting dragged into the bottom three picture, I think, as the season reaches its climax. But yeah, that could be like Yanis has said recently in the Carrow games, I think they'll show a little bit more ambition than maybe Derby did, for example. But it wouldn't surprise me if Robbins looks at that and incorporates some of those elements out of possession. So on you go. You're getting plenty of practice about how to break down low to mid blocks, teams who don't really want to press you high and maybe looking for turnovers and set plays. I could see all of those elements in play this coming weekend. So palpably not able to decode it against Derby and Preston to an extent. So, yeah, for me, it's going to be a challenge, I think, that. But after three games away, I would say Norwich probably need to certainly get that W on the board, because if not, all the elements we've discussed in the section around frustration, I think that's just going to continue to get magnified until they can, you know, start to get back to winning ways, because that's what gives Torup and Napper and those players that space then to breathe almost, and to try and evolve a little bit more and move a bit further down this evolutionary path they're on. When they're not winning games, the byproduct, the negative byproduct of that is increased scrutiny, increased focus, and some searching questions as well. So for those reasons alone, off the back of three games without a win, they definitely need to put that right on Saturday. And, you know, if you're going to ask me for an early prediction, I'm not going to give you one, because I'll wait until I know if Kenny McLean and Nunes are any chance of being involved, I think.
No, it wasn't actually for those reasons. So you've preempted me there. So that seems like an apt place to leave it. Paddy, thank you very much for your time. Thank you all very much. Whether you're watching us on YouTube, which of course you can do for all of these podcasts, if you want to see our beautiful faces on a Sunday after a long trip home from Hull, or if you prefer to listen and not have to endure that, then that's also fine. And we're available on all those podcast players as well. Thank you very much to First Bus, our sponsors, and thank you all very much for watching and listening. We'll see you next week, where hopefully we'll be talking about a Norwich City result, booking hotels at Wembley, and all of those good things on the positive end of that spectrum. See you then.